Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, May 10th, is the 78th birthday of Arthur Honeyman. He died 10 years ago at the age of 68. There are more eights, such as the day he died was December 8, 2008, which was the 86th anniversary of the Great Astoria Fire of 1922. He was born on May 10, 1940, with cerebral palsy of unsure origin, but perhaps from a bumpy continental automobile trip by his father and pregnant mother from Boston to Portland. Arthur was born at a stopover with family friends in Kansas. He lived most of his life on both coasts, but mainly Oregon. From his birth to his death, he was forced to overcome or live with personal handicaps caused by cerebral palsy, which included social restrictions and prejudice, such as Oregon's absurd and infamous, with a few other states, ugly laws, which made it a crime of public ugliness. He was once arrested for being publicly ugly in a restaurant. His adult life was consumed in combat for the rights of physically handicapped, and he gained wide renown for his invincible spirit and tenacious panache. Arthur wheeled around for several years in a cart built by his father. He had signs on the cart that read, "Spastic power is an irrational feeling, but so is love." His personal motto was, "Flow spasmodically." He wrote of himself, or actually dictated to someone because he could not hold a pen, "I am a spastic. I am a freak. My body shakes like four winds tearing at it from all points of the compass. My speech is tortured almost to being incomprehensible. I drool and vomit almost uncontrollably. I cannot eat unless someone feeds me. To go to the bathroom, someone has to take me and put me on the toilet and wait until I am finished. I have to be undressed for bed and dressed the next morning. I am an adult and have to be cared for like a six-month-old baby." But, he wrote, his mind was free. He was a writer, forced to arduously dictate with a spastic tongue until he got a computer, which he punched with one spastic finger, a scholar and a poet. One noted class that he taught at Portland State University while pursuing his master's degree was "The Grotesque in Literature, from Grendel to Quasimodo to Frankenstein." His own contributions to literature were several books of poetry, stories, and essays, all of which were published by Wheel Press, owned and operated by Arthur and his wife Joanne. He had a Bachelor's of Science degree in History and a Master's degree of Arts in English, both from Portland State University. He campaigned twice for the Oregon legislature, unfortunately unsuccessfully. Arthur was truly one of Oregon's most famous and unique crusaders for human rights of physically handicapped in particular and everybody else universally. I begin today's tribute to Arthur's natal day and to spastic power with his own description of cerebral palsy and its effects on those afflicted. Matrix of a Social Spastic by Arthur Honeyman. Cerebral palsy is perhaps one of the worst afflictions that can strike a person. Because I am a victim of this affliction, much of what I am writing centers around me. What I write is what I have observed from self-experience and from others who are also handicapped by cerebral palsy. I write not only about the physical problems of the cerebral palsy, but also show psychological problems a cerebral palsy victim suffers. I do not intend a long psychological... Pardon me, I have to start that one again. I do not intend a long and technical analysis, which I myself do not understand and cannot even hope to explain. I will satisfy myself by barely touching the definition and the causes of this affliction. Because cerebral palsy is not a disease, and because most cerebral palsy victims have internal organs which function normally, the average CP has no real health problems. For instance, I am rarely sick enough to stay in bed. Most of the literature which is written on cerebral palsy concerns the care of children stricken by it. I will try to restrict myself to the problems of the teenager and the young adult. Cerebral palsy is also known as Little's disease. Dr. Little was probably the pioneer in medical interest in what is commonly known as palsy or spasticity. The number of victims of cerebral palsy is estimated at various numbers. One book says there are 400,000 CPs in the United States, while another says there are 550,000. About 200,000 of these are children and 350,000 adults. It has also been estimated that every 53 minutes a child is born with cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is, of course, due to brain damage, probably to the medulla and cerebellum. Some injuries are prenatal, others perinatal, and others postnatal. Prenatal damage is generally due to two types of injuries, either hereditary or congenital. Tuberous sclerosis and Tay-Sachs disease fall under the first cause. Anoxia, maternal infections, metabolic disease, and Rh factors fall under the latter cause. Cerebral palsy due to perinatal, during birth, is generally caused by mechanical damage such as trauma. This includes squeezing the brain too hard during labor or by forceps in the process of delivery. There are prematurities, low vitamin K level, and anoxia. Perinatal also includes asphyxia, which is due to respiratory obstructions during labor. Postnatal refers to brain damage after birth. Such injuries as skull fractures and wounds come under trauma, which is usually brought about by falling on the head or by similar accidents. The second is infectious, caused by meningitis and encephalitis. Third is vascular by hemorrhage, thrombosis, and embolus. Anoxia is caused by carbon dioxide and or monoxide poisoning and neoplasms. There are several types of cerebral palsy. There is spasticity, which is usually characterized by short jerks or rhythmic spasms. Athetosis refers to a type of cerebral palsy in which the victim makes twisting, worm-like motions. This is the type I suffer. More often than not, spasticity and athetosis are intermingled, as with me. As with all CPs, these disturbances are caused by misdelivery of messages to the brain through the nerves. An example of an athetoid's problem of muscles is when an athetoid reaches for an object. Nerve cells misdirect the hands so that the object is not reached or knocked over. Also, in many CPs, hearing may be defective. The result is that the CP may appear to be stupid or uninterested. For centuries, the CP was regarded as an idiot because of spasticity, drooling, speech, and other compulsive traits. CPs can be paraplegics, which refers to two limbs, quadriplegics, four limbs, or hemiplegics, one side of the body. Because athetosis is the affliction I suffer, I am going to concentrate on it. Also, I believe it to be the most terrible of the various types of cerebral palsy. The reason is this. Many victims of athetosis are not able to write or feed themselves. They display annoying and unpleasant actions such as facial contortions and drooling and exhibit worm-like motions. This naturally means the CP is not readily accepted by society. Obviously, one can see what this would do to the average CP's social standing. The athetoid can be extremely strong physically and still not be able to attend to the simplest things, which the average person takes for granted. I can lift myself up by using an overhead bar so that my feet don't touch the ground, but I can't hold a glass of water. Not because I'm not strong enough, but rather because I am uncoordinated and the glass shakes out of my grasp. The harder I try to do something, the more difficult it becomes. I become excited and tremble, which almost everyone does from fear or excitement, to a much greater degree, however, than normal. I spasticate. One may ask, why not relax? Of course I should relax. I would be able to do all sorts of things. I would be able to speak better. But it is difficult for an athetoid to relax. It takes us rigorous and slow training and development of muscular control to relax. This depends partially on the severity of the affliction, partially on individual character, upbringing, background, and environment, and also on medical facilities as well as psychological or psychiatric treatment. I believe the greatest overall problem which a CP, especially an athetoid, faces is the problem of being socially accepted. One cannot rightfully expect to be accepted on an equal basis by society unless he or she proves equal to it. This is true whether it is blacks, Jews, alcoholics, or CPs. On the other hand, society must give each the equal chance to prove equal, which it does only reluctantly and slowly. This means minority groups must work twice as hard or more to achieve acceptance. This is extremely difficult for a CP, particularly the athetoid, because of the inability to function as well or as fast as the average person. It is also difficult to make friends because of spasticity, drooling, unpleasant facial expressions, and speech defects. Victims of other afflictions such as polio, muscular dystrophy, muscular sclerosis, and so forth, do not always accept CPs to be on their own level. CPs must prove to be equal to them. I first discovered this while attending a school for crippled children. I was shocked and hurt, and I don't think I have ever quite recovered from this realization. A roommate at the school coined an interesting but unoriginal phrase, "The only good CP is a dead CP." This, in essence, expressed the feeling of almost all who did not suffer cerebral palsy. Very few CPs marry, and very few have much of a home life, if any, after their parents die. It is a problem for the public to take care of those afflicted with cerebral palsy. For years, the problem was taken care of by conveniently tucking CPs out of sight and putting them in a dark corner where they lethargically pass the time. The public is slowly arriving at an awareness that the CP is included in the human race. There are special schools, special homes, special associations for the CP. However, there is a tendency to confine CPs, or all cripples, into one little social group. The life expectancy of a CP is considerably less than an average person. This does not mean they die early because of physical degeneration, but rather from psychological attitude. This attitude is primarily from not being accepted in society on an equal basis and not being able to do what the average person can do. Education is crucial to the survival of CPs as well as all handicapped persons, even more than to non-handicapped. The individual who is both versatile and efficient takes priority in the job market, especially when jobs are scarce. It requires skill to become and remain employed, even in the best of times. This is especially true now when people everywhere are being laid off. So-called able-bodied unemployed workers can do hard labor or other physically oriented tasks. Not so with CPs or other handicapped, who find it difficult to be employed at any time. Education doesn't guarantee jobs, but it does help, especially disabled job seekers. During times of government cutbacks, we handicaps have to be resourceful just to stay alive without financial aid from agencies or organizations of some kind, public or private. I would never have been employed without a decent education. Luckily, I was able to attend college. Both of my degrees, a BS in history and MA in English, have not directly related to any position I have held, but they give me more credibility than no degree. Combined with my real-life experience, my academic education has given me the skills to create every job I have ever had. Throughout the ages, the CP has been treated more as an animal than as a person. In ancient Greece, for instance, CPs were thrown over cliffs to their deaths because of their uselessness, as were all physical cripples. During the Middle Ages, they were locked away in dark pits along with the mentally insane. During the Renaissance period, artists depicted them as creatures in their works. A carving from ancient Egypt was dug up of a person whose body was deformed in such a manner to indicate that he suffered from cerebral palsy. It has not been until recently the CPs were allowed out into the streets and to intermingle in society. During the late 19th century, for example, CPs were confined to rooms and were more or less a thing nobody talked about. CPs are much better off than they have ever been, and the future looks brighter than the present. The promise that modern technology and medicine might come upon at least a partial cure has become more likely. More than that, the public is becoming more aware and understanding of the problems of cerebral palsy, which means CPs can hope for a more pleasant future. And that was Matrix of a Social Spastic by Arthur Honeyman. And now a poem that he wrote, Cripples Forever. Only a decadent society will let them live without any ulterior motive, quote unquote. We're not even good enough for institutions. Throw us off cliffs, Forget constitutions. Society can't afford the taxes. Should be sharpening axes. Soon you won't need to be frantic or frenetic. Blonde perfection will be automatic, genetic. I apologize for my existence. What's that? Christian resistance? Now, really, I mean realistically, survival and cripples. Forget idealistically, this ain't real, it's surreal. But drooling, incoherent, shaking, spastic, writes a poem for the City Club. Fantastic, iconoclastic. And Coker, crippled little bloker, keeps on stoking, pushing, shoving, screaming, burning, funny little arms, joking, the one-liner. Coker is a Shriner. So we're making demands, though we don't deserve to live, expecting reprimands. Do you realize how many desperate cries sweep the nation? Because there ain't no transportation. And in your deepest dreams, no arms, no jobs, just screams and the retarded. Oops, I drooled, I farted. Now, in society, today, yesterday, tomorrow, cripples don't make disturbing comment or ripples. I can tell this by the way you don't stare. Tain't fair, I swear, I swear, I swear to dare. Did you know there are black cripples, yellow cripples, red cripples, white cripples, mellow, lazy cripples, fat cripples, old cripples, cruel cripples? That's why they go to special school. Some of us shake, some crawl, don't do nothing but accept. Guess what? I got muscles. I got a bicep. How's that concept? Tell you what I am. I'm a cotton-picking rammer. So the truth is, across the bridge, on the other side, the revolution of the cripple is yet to be cried. It's evolution, and you, my friend, are helping the freak in its sporting trend. Each revolutionary freak may be the power of tomorrow. Power to the cripple. Power to the archetype, the limping hero. And that was something Arthur wrote, a poem, Cripples Forever. He wrote it in 1976. And the earlier article, Matrix of a Social Spastic, he wrote in 2001 and published it in the North Coast Times Eagle. And now, something else by Arthur, a true incident, a disgrace to uniformity. And I have read this on the air before. You might be familiar with it. Looking back on this incident, I have to admit to myself, at least, that I was terrified when I returned when I turned in my draft card. My fear was not of being imprisoned, for my draft status was 4F. Rather, my fear was based on the relatively innocuous concern of being socially spurned by relatives and somewhat influential friends of my family, most of whom supported any pro-American military action. And two, it had only been about 4 years since my then hawkish views led me to vote for Barry Goldwater. My about-face overnight conversion is another chapter in my personal history, but suffice it to say here that the following event involved a young man with cerebral palsy whose main ambition and struggle was to be accepted by the prominent as an individual of ability and substance. I believe the year was 1968. My about-face conversion to radicalism was fairly well established in a variety of ways. A conscientious objector and friend, more politically cognizant and committed than I was, had attempted to persuade me to make it a media event, but I idiotically refused to do so because I wasn't prepared to face the wrath of my family, which, I projected, would accuse me of selfishly exploiting both its prominent social status and my physical handicap for an unacceptable cause based on irrational and unrealistic principles. The result is that there was only minimal media coverage, all because of what I have come to regard as an act of cowardice on my part. I hasten to assure you I also regard it as an invaluable learning experience. My self-esteem remains intact somewhere in the realm of arrogance. Those were the days before I used a conventional wheelchair, when my mode of preambulatory transportation was via a walking vehicle built for me by my father. The days when I often crawled my way up steps, and when I was able to walk a short distance with the aid of someone holding onto my left arm. It must have been a startling spectacle, out of Marat Sade, as it were, to behold four or five young people straggle into the Portland Induction Center, one of them holding the left arm of the shaking, spasticating athetoid that I was, march up the stairs and on through the plate glass doors to the clerk's desk, where something of the following transpired. "What do you want?" asked a baffled and obviously shaken army private. "I am here to turn in my draft card," my mind uttered with extreme clarity while my mouth stammered and spat. One of my companions had handed me my card and a note that I had dictated to state my purpose and rationale. I shakily threw them onto the desk. The soldier read the note and asked my companions to explain to him, referring to me in the third person, as though I were not present, as officials often do, that my 4F meant I could not be drafted. One of them said, "Tell him." And I said, "Yes, I know. But if you really read my note, you'd understand that I'm still turning in my draft card." Somebody interpreted for me, and I turned around to leave, only to discover an audience of uniformed gawkers. My friend tightened his grip on my quivering biceps as the army private dialed his superior in command, a corporal. This uniform read my note and condescended to inform us, without looking at me, that we could not do this because it was against the law. My dear friends told him they were not doing this stupid thing. "Just him," they pointed at me. When the corporal told them to leave, they began to comply. But a stereotypically portly red-faced sergeant appeared on the scene, evidently apprised of the situation, and shouted at them to take me and my draft card with them. I yelled, "No." My friends began to leave again, but they were uniformly blocked while the sergeant called in the captain, who subsequently called in the colonel, who listened to me but called a doctor, who read my statement of purpose and then declared me mentally competent and capable of making my own decisions. The colonel reluctantly agreed to turn my card over to the draft board, but as my friends and I descended the steps, the red-faced sergeant forced my draft card into my shirt pocket. I jerked it out and threw it onto the steps. Back in my walker, I looked up at those numbed, uniformed faces staring at me. I don't recall what I felt or thought, but the echo of the red-faced sergeant's voice bellowing, "I hope you're proud of yourself," still lingers. Several weeks later, my name was announced on the radio as being one of a handful of Oregonians with the status of 4F who had turned in their draft cards. And now, something I wrote. Spastic politics, nothing to lose. One wintry night many years ago, Arthur Honeyman warmed himself sipping a wine known locally among friends as Red Death. He and a friend were well into the evening and a gallon jug. Politically romantic, tending to the left side of things in a poetic sense, Honeyman was deciding if he should try for the Oregon State Legislature a third time. His first two attempts were unsuccessful because he was a peripheral candidate campaigning on what was considered a limited political issue, the social and political needs of the physically handicapped. His friend was urging him to run again, but Arthur was reluctant. The antithesis of political charisma, slobbering, shaking spasmodically in a cart, tortuously able to talk, Honeyman was aware he would still be regarded as a freak, even among voters and peers who shared his opinions. The first two campaigns had a certain sense of theater about them that appealed to him. He had been a symbol. He stood up for and exemplified the miserable conditions and hardships physically handicapped persons experience daily. His appearance on the political scene had its desired shock effect. The unseen untouchable had become visible and piercingly embarrassing with his accusations of neglect and prejudice and his demands of social and political equality. Even the physically handicapped were taken aback because Honeyman was urging them to take political action themselves by refusing the dependency society was forcing on them. He lost both times, but losing did not diminish his excitement and satisfaction in trying. Personally, his major satisfaction was committing the unpardonable heresy of exposure. The catalytic visions of himself on the nightly news, staring directly at people in their homes, pinning them to their own walls, amused him. But this year of 1974 was a different question. The symbolic shock politics were exhausted. He certainly was not a household name, but neither was he an alien apparition. Pressure was on him from the liberal arm of the Democratic Party. Honeyman was advised that he had to go for broke if he ran, otherwise his presence on the platform would diminish the strength the liberal Democrats were shooting for. Politically, Honeyman had stereotyped himself as a freak. That was suicide. And he told his friend almost nostalgically he was bailing out of electoral politics. "I'm too radical," he said. "Honeyman, when it comes down to it, you're a damned liberal," his friend replied. He shook his head. "No, I'm a radical. A liberal is someone who thinks he's sane and wants to do sane things for the rest of the insane world. A radical knows he's as insane as the rest of humanity. A radical is desperate. He has nothing to lose and pities no one. A liberal has everything to lose and condescends to pity. Nothing is going to change for me. I'm a spastic and I've got nothing to lose." "Conservatives wish cripples were non-existent," Honeyman said, "and liberals claim with a smile that cripples are just as human as they are. But radicals think everybody's crippled," he said. He took a long sip of his wine through a straw and leered at his friend. "Do you have any more questions?" he asked. And that was Spastic Politics, Nothing to Lose, which I wrote for Metropolis Magazine at Portland State University in 1974. And sort of as an epilogue, I knew Arthur for 40 years from 1968 until his death in 2008, more eights, and have mourned in the past decade. I truly believe, especially in this neo-dystopian world we are regressing into, his presence. His was a heroic and good-humored life that benefited many thousands of others, disabled or not, and I believe his death has been the world's loss. I close today's program with something I wrote about Arthur 37 years ago today, on his 41st birthday in 1981. "We are born into life to die. Most of us pass through our time semi-conscious. Only a rare few seem able to perceive a fuller existence, and the rest of us are fortunate that some of them are compelled to give us themselves through the arts. Arthur Honeyman is one. His light into the soul is a spastic body. He is a man of indomitable spirit who has faced adversity on a scale with a frequency that would break most of us. He can move into a crowd of strangers and attract the most interesting among them like pieces of metal to a magnet. In other countries, such as Japan, the rare human beings who illuminate their era are honored as national treasures, as living monuments. Of course, Arthur Honeyman would be among them." This is Michael McCusker. Today is also Homer Simpson's birthday, whose creative father Arthur knew quite well, and Fred Astaire, whose life of dance Arthur would have loved to emulate. Tomorrow is Oregon's Discovery Day 226, and also the anniversary of Bloody Monday, 1970. Some of us remember that day very well, even after all these years.